This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, October 17th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from the 26th Annual Hospice Autumn Brunch, November 2nd from 11:30 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the home of Joni and John Dyer in Rogers. A seasonal buffet, live entertainment, and door prizes will be offered. Proceeds to benefit terminally ill patients in Northwest Arkansas. Tickets and more information available at 444-9888 or wregional.com. And support for KUAF also comes from the University of Arkansas School of Law, hosting the first annual Race Judicata NWA this Saturday morning, October 20th, beginning at 8:30 a.m. This 1K walk, run, and 5K race will benefit the Legal Aid of Arkansas. Registration and more information is available at racejudicatanwa.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we commemorate the Morrell Act on the 150th anniversary of it being signed into law. Also, Senator John Bozeman talks to Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net about the Farm Bill and more.
And the Caravan Sarai tour lands in Northwest Arkansas. All that and more, but first, hundreds of new jobs soon will be created in Northwest Arkansas. Matt DeCampbell, a spokesman for Governor Mike Beebe, says the details were unveiled this morning.
We were able to announce a new company in Rogers called Next Life, which is going to build a facility and hire 350 people in Rogers. They are a recycling company. They take post-consumer plastics, they call them, basically used plastic products, and they break it down into a resin that can be used for plastic products to be made new.
DeCampbell says the company's plan will reduce the carbon footprint for this kind of production by 70%, which will be good for the environment, while the jobs will be good for the area's economy.
They're going to be manufacturing-type jobs. It's going to be a matter of processing this plastic and creating this resin and then having it ready to be produced and to get out to all these companies. And they're building a headquarters as well, and they're going to look to have more joint ventures with other manufacturers and other companies. So we may see even more jobs in the future in more directions.
Next Life is based in Boca Raton, Florida, but the company also operates facilities in Frankfort, Kentucky, Sterling Heights, Michigan, and elsewhere across the country.
For the second time in a week, workers petitioning Walmart descended upon Bentonville yesterday to have their grievances heard. This time, members of Warehouse Workers United urged the retail giant to adopt a set of standards that would improve conditions for and in retaliations against workers at warehouses contracted with moving goods for the retailer. Warehouse Workers United Director Guadalupe Palma says while the group canceled a protest scheduled for yesterday afternoon, representatives of the group met with Walmart officials yesterday morning.
We had the opportunity to explain in detail to Walmart about the broken equipment, lack of water, retaliation, and even termination of workers who have been outspoken. Ultimately, we believe Walmart must adopt a responsible contractor policy that includes an independent monitoring process in which workers play a key role. We must elevate the quality of jobs in Walmart contracted warehouses, and that will not happen if Walmart ignores warehouse workers. The meeting that we had today was the first step.
While the warehouses in question are not owned or directly operated by Walmart, Palma says that the company is responsible for the conditions present for people working in the company's supply chain.
The warehouses that these workers work at move 100% Walmart merchandise. And Walmart itself has standards for suppliers that requires its own contractors to follow the law, promote freedom of association, and forbids retaliation against its employees. Its own standards call for safe and clean work environment. It encourages its suppliers to provide wages and benefits sufficient to provide workers with discretionary income. So clearly, they have a policy that can already be applied to these contracted warehouses.
Palma says while it is unclear whether Walmart will work to meet the group's requests, changes at the warehouses would not occur if the group hadn't made its voice heard to the company.
The roughly 160,000 customers of Fort Smith's water system can drink a bit easier. City leaders earlier this week officially celebrated the completion of an expansion to one of the city's water treatment plants. The project expanded the plant's available capacity from a daily amount of 30 million gallons to 40 million. Steve Park is the city's director of water utilities. He says the treatment plant expansions are part of a larger process of expanding the water supply, which began with the 2006 completion of expansions to Lake Fort Smith.
That reservoir has been projected to be able to meet the region's demand through the year 2060. The treatment plant that's attendant to the water supply will be expanded in sections as demand grows. You'll incrementally increase the plant to stay ahead of demand. The section we just completed should meet our demand projections through the year 2020. Ultimately, though, as part of the new improvements and the master planning of that site, we have made provisions for the future plant expansions up to 70 million gallons a day.
But before Fort Smith and other cities that buy water can make use of the treatment plant's larger processing capacity, Park says other expansions to the water system have to be made.
Part of what needs to happen is to meet growth for the city and our wholesale customers is to increase the delivery capacity from the lake to Fort Smith, which will also involve a third river crossing into the city. And we are undertaking the first 6.5 miles of that line to be bid out shortly after the first year in 2013. That will remove some of the current hydraulic bottlenecks we have to be able to deliver 40 million gallons a day from the plant.
The first phase of pipeline upgrades are being paid for through voter-approved sales tax bonds, while nearly $36.6 million expansion to the treatment plant was paid for through bonds funded through water rates. Park says the entire 31 miles of pipeline are set to be complete by the year 2020.
A researcher at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences yesterday received a federal grant to develop an individualized treatment system for traumatized children under the age of 5. The $1.6 million federal grant was awarded by the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration to fund the Arkansas Network for Early Stress and Trauma, or NEST. The network is a collaboration between UAMS, Mid-South Health Systems in Jonesboro, and Ozark Guidance Center in Springdale. According to a news release by the school, NEST will provide individualized treatment for young children who have experienced traumatizing events, including various forms of abuse, natural disasters, and domestic violence. The grant will also provide for training of at least 70 mental health professionals on methods of caring for young patients through use of evidence-based practices.
The School of Law at the University of Arkansas has joined a growing list of highly regarded colleges in the area. The university announced today that the National Jurist and Pre-Law magazines have both ranked the school the 14th best value in the nation. The rankings are based on schools' percent of graduates who pass the bar exam and the percent who get a job, weighing those numbers against cost of tuition and living and the average debt with which students graduate. It's the second year that the School of Law at the U of A was ranked among the top 20 institutions in both publications.
Tonight's weather forecast calls for clear conditions with a low in the lower 40s. Tomorrow, expect clear skies with a high of 61 in northwest Arkansas and a high of 68 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, expect partly cloudy conditions with a low of 45.
The Division of Agriculture at the University of Arkansas is hosting a special anniversary celebration of the Morrell Act, which created land-grant colleges across the country. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to the experimental farm at the Agricultural Research and Extension Center to talk with the director about the historic measure, as well as a spectrum of enabling legislation which later led to America's agriculture industrial revolution.
Von Skinner points to a patch of heavy sorghum stalks bending in the wind this late warm autumn afternoon off busy Garland Avenue filled with university traffic. Von Skinner's resident director of the Agricultural Research and Extension Center at the University of Arkansas.
We've had cotton plots and corn plots this past year. Back over here, closer to the south part of the experiment station, the plots we're looking at right here are biofuel plots. This is switchgrass.
Von Skinner was born in Carlisle, Arkansas, where his family raised rice, soybeans, and timber. Professionally, he's dedicated more than 30 years to assisting students and professors conduct agricultural research. But this month, Skinner's been tasked with organizing a 150th anniversary celebration commemorating the creation of the state's land-grant university system under the Morrell Act of 1862, which also led to the founding of the flagship Agricultural Research Center. The act, signed into law by President Abraham Lincoln, provided federal lands to every state in the Union to build land-grant colleges.
A senator from Vermont, Senator Morrell, sponsored legislation that took federal property and that was sold in each state to fund agriculture and mechanic studies in that state.
The Arkansas General Assembly in 1868 voted to establish an Arkansas land-grant college, empowering a board of trustees to choose a site. Interested towns submitted competitive bids. Fayetteville, with a $30,000 bond in hand, as well as a women's seminary and a small college already in place, won in 1871. The Arkansas Industrial University was built on the old McElroy homestead. An old farmhouse renovated into a school opened its doors to 8 students a year later. Old Main was constructed by 1875, and in 1899, the college was renamed the University of Arkansas. Previous to the Morrill Act, higher education in America tended to concentrate on classical studies, the arts, language, literature, science, law, theology, architecture, and medicine, the exclusive province of the elite, mostly. But in Arkansas, in the late 19th century, more than 90% of residents were farm families, many involved in commercial agriculture. So through the passage of another piece of federal legislation, the Hatch Act, the University of Arkansas became the host institution for a brand new Arkansas Agricultural Experiment Station 125 years ago.
At first, there was research around campus, pretty much where the, as my understanding, where the library is now. They had wheat plots and those kind of things there. And then in 1919, this property out here where the experiment station is now, the first section of that was bought, and over the next 25 years or so, parts of it were put together out of 5 parcels. And that's where we had, this part in here had apples and different row crops and animal science and those kind of things, and just an expansion of those kind of things. The Morrill Act itself, my understanding is, and why the we believe the United States did so well through the Industrial Revolution and in agriculture, is because the study of those things was not done elsewhere in the world. Most things that were studied at that time were not as applied as that. So to be able to get folks to get information to the farmers and have folks study those kind of things helped tremendously for the prosperity that I believe that United States has been able to enjoy.
And while this experimental farm we are standing on doesn't yield veggies and fruits to market, it does yield remarkable agricultural research.
Soybean research out here, high-yield soybean. I just talked to one of the graduate students that we have here, and he had a plot that cut 120 bushels an acre.
And we also have fruit crops here.
Yes, there's fruit crops here on the experiment station. We have blackberries and blueberries, and some of the crops were able to raise in the what look like greenhouses. They're called high tunnels. They don't have heat or light in them. It's used to trap the latent heat in the sun to try to extend the season for the certain crops so you can have fresh strawberries at Christmas.
The Hatch Act of 1887 championed scientific agricultural research early on, but the Smith-Lever Act of 1914, or the Agriculture Extension Act, established a cooperative agriculture extension system to extend useful and practical information to the American homemaker and farmer through the application of research.
Some of the experiment stations in the state, which I believe there's 10 or so, this one here in Northwest Arkansas, and there's also one in the Batesville area, the Livestock and Forestry Research Station, where they work on cattle research and those kind of things. The stations were placed in the state to help that region of the state do research that's interesting to the farmers in that area, and that's the reason they were placed there. Another example would be the fruit station there at Clarksville. They have peaches and grapes and blackberries and those kind of items there, and they do very good research there. Dr. Clark is a person that does lots of good research there. Also, another experiment station that's close here would be Kibler at Alma area. It's the vegetable research station, and the last several years they've been working with the edamame soybean. And if you've been to grocery store or to Sam's or someplace like that, the ones that you get now for the most part come from China, and they went through a harvest and they're learning things as they go. The drought this year was kind of difficult on things, but they've learned a lot from the process and look forward to the next year. And another experiment station in the state that I know well, it's been a while, but I used to work at the Rice Research and Extension Center, and they do rice and soybean and wheat and other research down there, and they're world famous at one time, and it may still be the case that it was one of the most visited experiment stations in the United States. So that's a very good station there. There's also a USDA research component to that there. So,
now, how do you go about getting the results of your research and experiments out to the farmers in the field so that they can adopt those best farming practices?
Yes, they are published or put in pamphlets or in journal articles. They also, the Cooperative Extension Service takes the information and applies that through demonstrations and meetings that they take the information of concern. For example, if there's a certain weed that's a concern to folks, you'll see people come to meetings saying, "How do we control this? This causing us a problem," and they're able to take the information that the professor or the project leader and his students are working on, and then try to get that information through the Extension Service to the farmers.
We also have a Northeast Research and Extension Center in Blytheville, a pine tree research station in Colt, a research station at Roer in Desha County, and a cotton research station in Marianna. The Arkansas Forest Resources Center resulted from passage 50 years ago of the federal McIntyre-Stennis Act that initiated support for forestry education and research. So who's paying for all this? Land-grant colleges are privy to federal grant funds. The appropriation varies from year to year and is determined for each state through a formula based on a census of small farmers. A major portion of the federal funds is matched by the state. And who benefits most are agriculture students.
It benefits the student body by, giving something to research on. It's something that they're interested in. They'll approach a professor that says that I have this project, or the student will come up with something in the category of their interest, and then they're able to get the classwork and the write a paper and defend a thesis or a dissertation to define a problem that they come up with a solution for, or at least work on that solution. So that's how students work out here. There's also hourly students. We have folks that we need other things taken care of out here on the experiment station, and those folks also help out here too. Just students are from either working on research or helping keeping the experiment station looking nice too. So
a second Morrill Act passed in 1890 authorized direct appropriations to establish land-grant schools with the intent of extending access to higher education to African-American students. Money would not be distributed to states that barred admission based upon race. Under the act, 16 Southern historically black colleges and universities were constructed. And everyone listening to this story is invited to bring their family to the University of Arkansas Farms to learn more about that and about all the other special history mentioned in this radio segment.
And that'll be on October the 20th, start at 9, and then we'll have tours that go out every once in a while into the field, and then there'll be things there at the Animal Science Arena inside and out for folks to look at, and we're hoping folks will come out, and we'll have wagon rides showing entomology or poultry science, animal science. We'll have some biofuel things, water use, horticulture, farm equipment technology, watershed research, and some other things out here that folks can take wagon rides around and look at. Then at noon, we'll have a program. Folks will talk a little bit about and have some slides about the Morrill Act and what we do out here, and then we'll have a free lunch.
The entire event is free, actually, courtesy your state land-grant college. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe has issued a proclamation designating October 20th as University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture Day. To learn more about the University of Arkansas Fayetteville celebration, visit aaes.uark.edu.
So when Steve was a little boy, he said, "Daddy, what do you do for work?" And Pops,
he took out a little piece of paper and he wrote, S-P-Y. My dad's a spy.
On the next Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, we go deep undercover. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Snap Judgment, Saturday afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. John Bozeman was elected to the Senate in 2010 after serving for nearly a decade in the House of Representatives. On a recent swing through the state capitol, Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net sat down with Senator Bozeman and discussed a variety of different policy issues important to Arkansas commerce. Roby asked Senator Bozeman a number of questions submitted by TalkBusiness listeners.
Another question that we got a couple of questions on centers around the Farm Bill, which has been left unresolved since Congress recessed. What's the holdup in getting a farm bill passed? When will it finally get done? What are some key provisions in the farm bill for Arkansas in terms of what you think needs to be in there? And I guess in the committee meeting, they'll have to hammer out all these details, I guess, after the election.
Yeah, the farm bill is so important, not only to Arkansas, but to the country. We forget, you know, in Arkansas, this is probably the leading economy producer, you know, that we have in the state. And you go to a state like California and you think Silicon Valley and all of that, but agriculture is the leading thing in the state of California. So again, it's so important that we get this thing done. This is not about Democrats and Republicans and, you know, disagreements with that. It's about regional agriculture. Here we have southern agriculture that irrigates a lot. They're not too concerned about getting a crop because when you put the water and the fertilizer to it, things grow. They can control that. What they worry about is during the growth period is that their input costs go up dramatically and perhaps the price fails, and so regular crop insurance doesn't work for them. Crop insurance works for the Is, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, you know, places like that. So they've got different concerns, and then you've got the wheat growers out west. The key is to mold all of that together. And I think at the end of the day, Frank Lucas and the committee chairman in the House and the committee chairman in the Senate, Senator Stabenow, will get that resolved. The other component is trying to reform the food stamp program. And we think of the Farm Bill in terms of, you know, of all of this money going to farmers. The reality is only of a $1 trillion bill over 10 years, only $200 million goes to farmers, $800 million, the vast majority, goes to the food stamp program. In the Senate, we were only able to cut that $4 billion of the $800 billion, you know, which is not a substantial cut. Mm-hmm. And don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that we need to cut to people that actually need, you know, but there is vast room for improvement in the program. It needs to be reworked, and we could save a lot of money and help those in need, okay? So that's really the sticking point, is how do you get enough votes, conservative votes, that will vote for a farm bill that where you have real reform in the food stamp program, which definitely needs to be done, and then how do you do that without knocking off all the liberal votes? And so you've got that and then the commodity aspect. But at the end of the day, and I'm not really quite sure how, at the end of the day, we're going to get it done this year. And it is vital to the state of Arkansas. It's vital to our farmers. The other thing is, and this is so important, this is one of the things that's putting a wet blanket on the economy. I was with a young farmer the other day. He wants to buy a tractor. He can't do that because he doesn't know what the rules are going to be for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. As a result, he's not going to take out a loan. He's not going to, you know, buy that tractor, so the implement dealer will not be able to make a profit, and then in a small community in Arkansas, plow that in. So there's all kinds of reasons that we need to get this done.
This is from a veteran. I'll have to clean up a little bit of this question here to remove one of the expletives, but ask Senator Bozeman why he voted against a veterans aid bill that he authored.
Well, Rachel Maddow said I authored that.
And, okay.
And it was really a crazy deal. What, you know, I've been very active on the Veterans Affairs Committee, you know, for years, in fact, since I was in Congress. And so Congress, Senate, I've been there 11 years. The first bill that we passed in the Senate, first bill we authored was about traumatic brain injury, you know, and helping with that, and got that mixed in with another bill. What happened with this was I had a bill that had to do with veterans coming out of the service, transitioning back into the workforce. Senator Murray took my idea, changed it, put it in her bill, okay? And then wrote a bill, did that with some others, which is very common. I'm not complaining about that at all. And then essentially wrote a bill and presented it. I in no way authored the bill. I'd never seen the bill, you know, till it came out, and it had some good stuff in there and it had some bad stuff in there. So I felt like we could have cleaned the bill up, you know, in the sense of making some amendments. Senator Reid put it on the floor, and first thing he did was the Office of the Parliamentarian ruled that it wasn't paid for, okay, that it broke the Budget Act. So, you know, what we wanted to do was have the ability to amend it. We could have worked that out, you know, gotten a good pay for. Mm-hmm. Senator Reid chose not to amend the bill. So I voted against not breaking the budget caps. Again, you can't have trillion-dollar deficits year after year. Sends it back to committee, and then we go forward.
Give me some insight here, because I'm not up there every day, and I don't see this behind the scenes. Do you have conversations with Senator Reid, or do you strictly caucus with Republican members and stay kind of in line with that membership and have conversations there?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's interesting that the Senate is a very small place, and so you get to know people. The bill that Senator Murray took, that was my bill, it was also Senator Begich's bill. We did it together, okay, that she changed, you know, and stuck in her bill. So no, not at all. But again, and the sad thing about this veterans deal is that veterans issues really have been very bipartisan, mm-hmm. you know, through the years. And so this was just a point to try and embarrass Republicans by having to vote against this. What it did was it didn't kill the bill, it just sent it back to committee, so you have to get the pay for straightened out.
Yeah.
The other problem with the bill, the main portion of the bill, we've got to get, you know, we've got to help veterans get back to work, okay? There's no ifs, ands, or buts. What it did was it created a Jobs Corps program, and when you figured it out, each veteran got about $50,000. So the veteran would have a job, you know, working for the federal government in the forest or something for about a year to a year and a half. Then when the money went away, the job went away, okay? And so we said, well, you know, let's do the job training, but let's make a provision in there. This is how we wanted to amend it. Let's put a provision in there that with attrition, veterans would have first preference, so they could actually, you know, as the government workforce through attrition, retirements and stuff, they would have preference, you know, to fill those jobs in those areas, and then they'd have a real job, you know, that would last forever. Those are the common sense things mm-hmm. that you need to do, rather than some short-sighted deal that just boosts employment so you can brag about it for a year.
Two quick questions. Another kind of state issue kind of came to a head last week was the Americans for Prosperity ad that is on television. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it or not. It basically cites some economic statistics about Arkansas that they could do better. Governor Beebe took great offense to it, I'm sure you've read. You've been an office holder during this tenure. What's your reaction to that controversy?
Well, it's hard. You know, I'm, you know, I think my family moved to Fort Smith in 1871, and in fact, I tell people, you know, that's where the U.S. Marshals Museum is going to be built, and they had Descendants Day and all of those kind of things, and they asked me if I was a descendant of the Marshals, and I said, no, my great fear is that they were going to find that I was a descendant of the guys that they were, you know, rounding
putting in jail. That's right.
But no, you know, we can be very, very proud of our state. Certainly, you know, we've got tremendous room for improvement, and we're all committed to doing that. This is a very, very difficult time economically, and you know, when you have a situation where you have to live within your means, you know, like the state of Arkansas, it really does make for some tough choices. On the other hand, I'm a guy that feels like we can run leaner and meaner. You know, and always do a better job, a significantly better job in some areas.
U.S. Senator John Bozeman recently spoke to Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net during a visit to the state capitol. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon Communications store near you or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at cegpartners.com.
It is Wednesday, the 17th of October, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Once a week or so, we try to tell you what's going on in the region.
You bet.
And we usually focus on music.
Mm-hmm.
So, Thursday in Tulsa, ZZ Top at the Hard Rock Casino.
And I think they have a new album out.
Really?
I think I just read
that. Like a best of? Or
no,
like
I think it's new music. I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever know, but I think they have a new CD out.
We'll look it up after this.
Yeah. All right, fun. On October 24th, the Red Hot Chili Peppers are at the BOK Center in Tulsa.
Fun.
In Dallas, Madonna's doing shows on October 20th and 21st at the American Airlines Center.
Huh.
On October 26th in Dallas, GWAR is at the House of Blues. I want to stop and address GWAR for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Please do.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never seen GWAR and you're under 80, you should really go see this band once. Big costumes. You should wear a white t-shirt and plan to preserve it because the big costumes spew all sorts of interesting things. It's performance art. You should consider it.
Considered? Denied. But go ahead. To each their own.
Okay, in Little Rock, on the 25th.
I feel like we have a lot going on this week anyways, Kyle. So
there you go.
Okay.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah, well, there's another opportunity.
Okay.
In Little Rock on the 25th, the Red Hot Chili Peppers at the Verizon Arena.
Mm-hmm.
In St. Louis on Saturday, the Deftones at Harrah's.
Fun.
On the 27th, Justin Bieber at the Scott Trade Center.
That's where Kyle will be.
And I'll be there. No, I won't. But I would be October 28th for Primus at the Peabody Opera House.
They're pretty loud.
That's why I like them.
Okay.
In Kansas City on the 25th, Grace Potter and the Nocturnals at the Uptown Theater.
Oh, which is a fantastic place to see a show, by the way.
It
the
is,
Uptown.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
On October 30th, Madonna at the Sprint Center. And on October 30th, as close as Kansas City, really you should go, GWAR at the Beaumont Club. If I can get some folks together, I'm there.
Well, write and tell me how it is.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Round two pits Mitt Romney and the president toe-to-toe, town hall style, as the latest polls paint one or the other ahead by a hair. But wait, Honey Boo Boo just announced her endorsement. I'm Neil Conan, Ken Rudin, the political junkie on The Week in Politics, and from gay marriage to gambling, ballot measures to be decided November 6th, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
If you're looking for something to do to celebrate the Halloween season, how about a dinner party with some dead people? For nearly a decade, the Peel Compton Foundation has hosted ghost walk tours in October. This year, a new event called Tales at Twilight is taking its place. Connie Hendricks-Krall, the executive director of the nonprofit organization, says it was time for a change.
For people who are familiar with special events, there's a rule of thumb that special events have a lifetime of about 7 years. This one had run for more years. It needed to be tweaked. And after last year, we all sat down and realized that there were some real logistical nightmares. Cemeteries, I guess it kind of goes together. We'd been doing the walks in the cemetery, and then they would go over to Peel Mansion. Well, there's two problems with that. They have to find parking near the cemetery. Then they have to transport themselves about a mile away back to Peel. And if you had bad weather, forget it. This way, with the new revision, we don't ever have to worry about weather. We also don't have to worry about daylight.
Tales at Twilight will premiere October 23rd and is presented by the Peel Compton Foundation in cooperation with Rogers Little Theater. The event will feature dinner and performances by local actors. Dinner will be catered by the main event, and the menu includes harvest roast chicken with fall vegetables and cobbler. During the tour portion of the evening, guests will be led to specific parts of Peel Mansion to watch actors perform three short vignettes. Connie, who has degrees in journalism and history, conducted much of the research herself and wrote the scripts for the short scenes. One of the vignettes features Colonel Samuel West Peel.
I knew that I wanted to incorporate as much of the Peel family because, after all, the mansion is named after them. They were a very prominent family in the sense that they were leaders in Northwest Arkansas in the 19th century. Then when you throw in the fact that Colonel Peel's brother-in-law was governor of Arkansas and then later was a senator, it just really made for perfect history. I'd done enough reading also to realize that Colonel Peel had been good friends with William Jennings Bryan. There's enough reference to that. I will admit I took a few liberties, but there's enough in the record to justify this. And as I researched William Jennings Bryan, kind of compared everything, I decided I would go with the year 1896 because that would have been the first time he was nominated for president. And there's a lot of similarities between that election and the one going on right now. The Midwest was going to be really the battleground then as it is now. So I put the three men in our parlor and had them reminisce.
This is just one of three scenes visitors will experience. Guests will be led into a room where they will see a frozen scene, which will then come to life as actors begin reciting their lines. Once the scene, which will last about 15 minutes, plays out, the actors will freeze again. Guests will then listen to a short narration at the end of the performance before continuing on to the next scene. A second vignette is based on the story of a doctor performing a surgery gone awry on a young girl with appendicitis. It features a bit of a surprising turn of events. The third vignette will feature Hope Holmes, one of the participating actors from Rogers Little Theater.
My vignette is where Mrs. Peel and her daughter Catherine are with two of the ladies of the area, I guess you'd say, or society ladies, putting food baskets together for the poor. Interesting, Mrs. Peel went through some really tough times when she was younger, and starvation was part of that. And she pretty much made that her passion to make sure she her and her family were never in that dire straits again, and the people of the community were helped out as well. So she, that was her passion, is to helping the community, help feed the poor.
Those attending Tales at Twilight can help feed local people by bringing 5 canned food items or 2 non-perishable items to the event that will be donated to a local food bank. Hope is one of more than a dozen actors working on this event. The group touring the vignettes will be subdivided, so all vignettes will be occurring simultaneously throughout the house, which means actors will have to perform their scenes 6 times each night. Though it does require much preparation with costumes and rehearsals and installing additional lighting in the mansion, Hope, a self-proclaimed history buff, is looking forward to the event, which will showcase what life was like during 3 different time periods.
I think it's something that the community really needs to get on board with. We don't have anything like this around Northwest Arkansas as far as reenactments. I mean, we've got the Civil War over at Pea Ridge and various places, and that's great, but there are a lot of historic places around Northwest Arkansas that have stories to tell. And I think that this could be something that, you know, going forward, that other places can do as well. And, I mean, bring history to life. How much more fun is that, you know? it'll be great for the kids because, I mean, they sit in the classroom and they hear about this stuff. But when you can see it, I mean, like any movie or anything like that, it just pops off, you know, the page at them. So, yeah, I think this will be something fun. And I hope that the, you know, community can take a look at this and say, that's something that we could do with our historic places as well.
Connie Hendricks-Krall, executive director of the Peel Compton Foundation, says this new event will provide another way to celebrate the Halloween season.
I think it's a different way to enjoy Halloween. You know, for people that are real Halloween buffs, first of all, Peel House at night is just really spectacular. I think you'll just get a big kick out of that. The second thing is, you know, you just don't see live reenactments right before your eyes. I mean, you're going to be very intimate because you're only going to be a few feet away from the actors as they stage that. And I think the between the history and then the, what I call my fun vignette with the little girl, I think it'll just make for an unusual evening.
Tales at Twilight has performances scheduled for 6:30 p.m. October 23rd through 25th at Peel Mansion in Bentonville. Tickets are $25 for those 18 and older, $20 for 12 to 17-year-olds, $12.50 for 6 to 11-year-olds, and children younger than 6 are free. The ticket price does include a meal in the carriage house, and reservations are encouraged. More information is available at peelcompton.org/tales.
That's music from Majid Bekas and the Ganawa Ensemble, headliner of the Caravanserai Tour that's in Northwest Arkansas this week. The Caravanserai Tour takes its name from the gatherings in the Far East where travelers would rest and exchange music, poetry, and art. The modern-day version travels to 4 or 5 communities each year, and each of those tours is dedicated to promoting the art of a different Muslim country. This year, the country is Morocco. Caravanserai is produced by Arts Midwest, and this year's tour also has stops in Jamestown, North Dakota, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and Nashville. The tour will be inside Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville tomorrow night, but has already been performing in the area, including a show at Bentonville High School yesterday morning. Yesterday afternoon, Zeba Rahman, the artistic director for Caravanserai, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, and I asked her about yesterday's school concert.
It was amazing. There were more than 1,700 high school kids gathered in this wide open space, and all the musicians, Brahim Fribgen with his electric oud, Majid Bekas with his gimbri, you know, this bass instrument, a very African bass instrument, and his ensemble performed in front of these high schoolers. And at the end, they had him up and dancing. It was incredible. They were trying out the very complex and wonderful dance steps that the Ganawa have, which is syncopated totally.
What else will... Okay, so the electric oud will be there tomorrow night. What else can people expect to experience at Walton Arts Center?
They're going to be in for a real treat because the Majid Bekas Ensemble, headed by Majid Bekas, is from the Ganawa tradition. And the Ganawa, as I was saying a little earlier, are that community that moved into Morocco from the old kingdom of Mali and Sudan. They were either part of a group of enslaved people, or they came up, you know, centuries ago and settled in Morocco, in the south of Morocco, either as traders or maybe they were drafted into a prince's army. But in any case, there is a Ganawa community, and they are African, rooted in African culture, in West African culture, and this music, which is healing music, comes from the storytelling tradition of West Africa, is very beautiful. It's very soulful, it really draws on the old cultures in Africa and uses still some of the words in Swahili mixed with Darija, which is the Arabic dialect that's spoken in Morocco. It's amazing music. And the predecessor of blues and gospel.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the communities that are on this year's Caravanserai, Jamestown, North Dakota, Fayetteville, Arkansas, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, you don't think of these places as places that necessarily have large Muslim populations or large African or Moroccan populations. There are some here, a very active student organization here. But part of the idea here is to go to places that perhaps don't have large populations, right?
That's right. And, you know, in large urban hubs, you have opportunities to listen to all kinds of music and have, you know, a rotation of world cultures coming through in various art forms. And it's a little harder, I think, in the smaller communities. It's So this is something that, again, David Freyer from Arts Midwest conceived of as a means to bring to communities that have less access to Muslim cultures, caravanserai. And I believe this, certainly this is David's vision, it's Adam Perry's vision, that when people sit side by side and they actually share music, you know, you open up notions, preconceived notions that you may have read in the news or heard from somebody about a group of people. Change when you're sitting face to face with each other. You can ask questions, you can laugh together, you can eat together, you can jam together. It makes all the difference, and that's really the point of this.
The musicians performing tomorrow night are just part of a wave of artists connected with Morocco coming to Northwest Arkansas in the next several months.
Then we have in the spring the Orchestra of Fez, which is a chamber orchestra of traditional Andalusian music from Fez, the ancient city. And its guest artist is going to be Françoise Atlan, who's actually Jewish, and she lives in Morocco, and she's from the Sephardic Jewish tradition. In the 13th century, in the Middle Ages, in the Old Kingdom of Al-Andalus, Muslims and Jews and Christians lived in relative peace together, and they collaborated a lot culturally and in other ways, in other civic ways also, but particularly culture. So Jewish Andalusian music, Sephardic music, and Muslim Andalusian music is the same. And so we're going to see that when the Fez Orchestra and Françoise Atlan come through in the spring. Then we have the film program, and that will be in the winter with Hakim Balabas, who's a wonderful filmmaker. He does both documentaries and feature films. He'll be here to show two of his films, two short films, and talk about his, you know, growing up in a small town in Morocco. Finally, we have the photography program, and that's new for the Moroccan edition. So we've collaborated with a wonderful curator named Nawal Slawi from Casablanca, and she has brought on three excellent photographers, young photographers, two women and a man, who are going to share their Morocco with us. The title of the exhibition is Morocco in Transition.
Zeber Rahman is the artistic director for Caravanserai. The Caravanserai tour stops at Walton Art Center in Fayetteville tomorrow night. And Zeber says not only will there be great music as part of the performance, but acrobatic dancing as well. For more information about Caravanserai, you can go to the website caravanserai-arts.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 17th of October, 2012. It's the birthday of Shinichi Suzuki, born in Nagoya, Japan, 1898, who gave us the Suzuki violin method, teaching children to play classical music by listening and imitating as they imitate speech. It's the birthday of Arthur Miller, New York City, 1915. His father was the wealthy owner of a coat factory. Family had a big apartment, a chauffeur, summer home at the beach, and then lost everything in the stock market crash of 1929. Had to move to a poor section of Brooklyn, into a six-room clapboard house where Miller had to share a bedroom with his grandfather. His uncle on his mother's side, Manny Newman, lived in the neighborhood. Uncle Manny was a salesman. He was a big talker, had big schemes for the future, even though he was struggling to make ends meet. Miller got involved in drama when he was in college, wrote a play, All My Sons, 1947, and just before the Broadway premiere, he went to an advanced performance in Boston. Standing outside the theater, looked up and saw his uncle Manny, whom he had not seen in years, realized that Manny was on a business trip to Boston. He'd come to the play on a whim. Arthur Miller said, I could imagine his grim hotel room, the long trip up from New York in his little car, the hopeless hope of the day's business. And a year later, Miller learned that his Uncle Manny had committed suicide. He decided he had to write a play based on his uncle's life. He talked to Manny's two sons, interviewed them, and then holed up in a tiny cabin in Connecticut and sat down and wrote Death of a Salesman, produced in 1949. In the last scene of the play at Willie Loman's funeral, one of the characters says, for a salesman, there is no rock bottom to the life. He don't put a bolt to a nut. He don't tell you the law or give you medicine. He's a man way out there in the blue, riding on a smile and a shoeshine. And when they start not smiling back, that's an earthquake. A salesman is got to dream, boy. It comes with the territory. It's the birthday of Nathaniel West, born New York City in 1904. He was managing a hotel in New York City when he met a woman who wrote an advice column for the newspaper. She showed him a few of the letters she'd gotten from readers. She thought they were funny. Nathaniel West thought they were heartbreaking. And he wrote his first novel, Miss Lonely Hearts, about an advice columnist. Later, having moved to Hollywood, he wrote his novel, The Day of the Locust. And it's the birthday of Jimmy Breslin, Jamaica, New York, 1930. Newspaper man, novelist. Latest book is Branch Rickey, about the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who integrated Major League Baseball. Jimmy Breslin, who said, newspaper men don't go to bars anymore. They go to health clubs and then go home. They're in fantastic health, but they wish they were in the bar, and their wives wish they were in the bar, too. Here are two little poems for today, two limericks written by Robert Frost in 1898. He was 24. There was a man went for to harm a quiet but human old farmer. Now he wishes he'd known to let folks alone, for this is the doctrine of karma. There was a young poet who tried making boxes when preoccupied. One day he made one, and when he got done, he had nailed himself on the inside. Two limericks by Robert Frost from the collected poems of Robert Frost, published by Library of America. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Murray.
Oh, where's Murray?
Newton County. Supposedly the inspiration for Staymore in Donald Harrington's novels.
Oh, that's right.
Got some tickets to give away. James McMurtry,
yes.
Singer-songwriter extraordinaire from Texas, is coming to George's Saturday night. We have three pairs of two each. I'm going to ask you a question. You've got to send me a correct answer to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Yes.
James McMurtry was born in Fort Worth. Fort Worth is the fifth largest city in Texas, behind Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, and Austin. All I need to know is give me one of the other towns, cities that's in the top 10 in Texas. So 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10 by population.
Excellent. So all I got to do is email that answer to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
That's correct. If you want it to be really easy, I'll post on Facebook one of the answers.
There you go.
The Ozarks at Large page on Facebook.
Excellent. That works.
Very good. Both saw the Avett Brothers last night.
We did.
I thought it was a fantastic show.
It was a good show. I like outdoor concerts. I really do.
They are the most prompt rock and roll band ever.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely.
You know, we were strolling in at 7:32, and the first drums of the banjo were going.
Yeah, I think we were right behind you. And I heard them just start. And they didn't have an opening act, which I thought was interesting, but they played for two and a half hours.
It was fantastic.
And you never got bored.
No.
They didn't seem tired.
No.
It was great. It was
and
very,
they said that they had gone to Hugo's.
They did mention that. They mentioned that they had been around town the day before and had kind of wandered around. Everyone had been real nice, and they were very appreciative, and the crowd was very appreciative. So Good concert all around.
That's right.
Excellent. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition.